I'm very pleased to be here today. I'm very grateful to be part of a tremendous session. And I'm also very grateful that you folks decided to come here instead of go to the zoo or the aquarium. You know, I had this terrible experience about 2 years ago. I was giving a talk to a huge group. It was probably 4,500, 5,000 people. And it was about childhood obesity because we were doing a lot of studies on childhood obesity. On the very opening slide, I had this really kind of embarrassing photo of this very heavy little boy, about 8 or 9 years old, who's sitting on a couch just eating all sorts of food, and he's surrounded by food. And I thought it was kind of a cool picture. But that night after the talk, I had this terrible dream. And in this dream, I imagined that that day during the talk, that little boy was sitting way in the back, crying the whole time. Well, it gets worse, because also in the dream, his parents were there, and they're crying over on the other side. And then even worse was, in back of him was a group of school kids, his friends, or his classmates, laughing at him. So my lesson at that point was, if I'm ever going to have embarrassing pictures of children eating in a slideshow, they're going to be mine. So we're going to be looking at mindless eating and mindless solutions kind of at home. What can be done tonight? Okay. Now, as part of the caveats, everybody else talked about that they didn't have a conflict of interest. Well, I have a real tendency to sort of drive off the highway in these presentations. And so what I have to say is that today's ideas do not represent my employer, which is the USDA's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion. They represent my view. When I was asked to give this talk by Roland a while back, at that point, he said, talk about the research you're doing. And this is the research that's going on in my lab up at Cornell. So in 2001, I had this tremendous road to Damascus conversion. Okay, now, I'd been a professor since 1990. And I thought I kind of did some things that generated some research insights, but I very quickly began to realize that I was really bad at generating awareness of these insights among the people who could use them most. Furthermore, if I did miraculously make somebody aware of something, they didn't really make the decision to change, and they sure as heck did not act and change. And this was so powerful of a conversion experience for me that what I ended up doing was starting a small little clinical operation with a couple dietitians and a clinical psychologist where we'd actually take the stuff we're doing, work with people who came into the clinic to figure out what can we do to make this most likely to result in change in their life. Then we also used it as an opportunity to look at what questions or problems are they dealing with that can be things that we can study that might be able to make a difference. And it made a dramatic difference in the way I approached things. I'll talk a little bit about that now. And part of it was, I wasn't seeing it as personal responsibility if they didn't come through. I saw it as my responsibility that I'm messing up somehow. And there's some way I can be a little bit more effective in either coming up with better research questions that have a clear point to them or communicating them better. So here's the roadmap. I'm going to talk about four curious findings about mindless eating. Then I'm going to talk about three myths that drive overeating in the home, mindless solutions for the home, and then something called the small plate movement. All right. Four curious findings about mindless eating at home. We did a study a while back on stockpiling salience, where what we did is we stuffed people's houses full of food. You know, 36 bags of chips, you know, 5 gallon barrels of pretzels, the stuff you typically buy when you go to Sam's Club. Okay. And what we found a number of things. One of the things we found is that there's this tremendous acceleration in consumption that occurs for about the first 6 or 7 days in most people's house. In fact, they end up consuming things at twice the rate if it's stockpiled. Now, a couple of studies we did after that actually showed that this is because of stock pressure. It's the idea that every time you open the cupboard and you see 36 bags of chips, you initially have to ask yourself, do I want some chips? And if you don't see them, you don't ask that question. But the more you ask that question, the more you're likely to take it. We did some of the package sizes. This was back in 1995 and showed that as you increase the size of any package, it also increases the amount people pour and they end up, or serve themselves, and they end up consuming about 92% of what they serve themselves. After when this came out, I found this so compelling that I got in my Jeep, I lived in Philadelphia at the time, and drove to Nabisco, I drove to M&M Mars, I drove to Kraft, Kellogg's, and Unilever to say, look, if you come up with something called like small size packaging, I called them mini-sized packs at the time. You can probably help people control what they eat, and you can still actually make a pretty decent profit. It took them about 8 years before any of them did it. But anyway, it eventually happened. With perceived variety, we found, when Deborah talked about the other study, we found that you don't even have to change variety. If all you do is alter a person's perception by the way it's ordered on a buffet line or the way jelly beans are shook up, you'll end up in some cases doubling how much people eat. And then the last study that Deborah also alluded to, we did a study in the British Medical Journal a while back where we showed that we could take bartenders, and because of something called an elongation bias, that when they pour in a short, wide glass, it's kind of the tumblers you'd see in bars, they, on average, end up pouring 25 to 32% more into a tumbler than they do in a tall highball glass. Now, even when we say, look, you poured 25% more in, do you want to try it again? What do you think happens? Same thing. Yeah, maybe it's 23% the next time. Well, what's going on here? Now, I assumed that when I was doing this that these weren't really connected other than in some way. But I think the exact same drivers are operating in all four cases. First of all, regardless of whether we look at this class of issues or the millions of others, I think they all do two things that mess us up when it comes to consuming. They all make consumption more difficult to monitor. They make it harder for us to figure out exactly how much we consumed, whether it be because of the size perception biases or whether it be because we're seeing too much variety and we're thinking we're eating the same amount. But the second thing they do is they all provide a perceptual suggestion of what is the appropriate consumption norm. In all these cases, what they do is they bias our view of what's natural. Now, knowing this, I think it gives us a lot of ideas as to what can be done to change things. And the first thing, being in public health, all of us would be interested in doing is education. Well, I was giving a talk at the Institute of Medicine a short time, I guess maybe about 2 years ago, and I happened to mention the stuff we were doing with plate sizes, and that, you know, if you increase the size of a plate from 10 to 12 inches, people ended up pouring a whole lot more but didn't realize it. Because perceptually, you know, 4 ounces on a 10-inch plate looks like quite a bit. 5 ounces on a 12-inch plate, it doesn't even look like an appetizer, so you put on more. So I'm there, and somebody, I just said it parenthetically during the talk, and somebody said, well, surely something as basic as the size of a bowl or plate wouldn't influence how much an informed, intelligent person eats. Well, so at the time what I did is I took a class. These are MBA students in a very competitive MBA university, very smart. I took a section of the class, and instead of teaching whatever is supposed to be taught that night, I instead did one thing. And the one thing was, for 90 minutes, I told them in a million ways that if I gave them a gallon-sized bowl of Chex Mix, they would take a lot more than if I gave them 2 half-gallon bowls. It's pretty heady stuff there, isn't it? Well, I lectured. I had commercial. I showed demonstrations. We had videotapes. I had them break into groups to say, how could you prevent this from happening to you? We did interpretive dancing. I mean, and they went home, okay? Now, 6 weeks later, they came back from winter vacation, and I invited them to a Super Bowl party at a place called Jillian's, at the sports bar. Anybody familiar with these things? Or yeah, they're chains. It came to Jillian's, 2 rooms. They were divided up into 2 equal groups. One group went singly to one room where there's a table just like this with big gallon-sized bowls of Chex Mix. They'd serve themselves. When they got down to the end of the table, somebody asked them to fill out a questionnaire related to who's going to win the game. And the only place where they could put the bowl down was a spot that had a scale underneath it. Yeah. As soon as they did it, it registered in the other room how much they took. Now, at the same time, in the parallel room, the exact same thing was going on, but it was going on, people were given twice as many half-gallon bowls. Exact same thing. Now, at the end of the evening, we ended up finding that the people who had the served themselves on the bigger bowls, even though they were intelligent, informed people, served 53% more food. Yeah, and they pretty much ate everything they served, too. But now, what do you suppose they said when leaving the restaurant that night, when we stopped them and said, you know, you ate almost 50% more than the group that was in the other room that but had smaller serving bowls. Do you think the bowl size had anything to do with that? What do you think they say? Say, well, why'd that happen? Well, I didn't have breakfast yesterday. Well, we did the same experiment with stale popcorn in movie theaters. The same thing happens. We did it with the glasses. The same thing happens. It was interesting. I gave a talk at one of the big FinC meetings a couple years or so ago, and I just happened to mention that the glass pouring thing. It's the last thing I mentioned in my talk. The first person in the microphone ignored the first, I guess, 89 minutes of the talk and just asked the question, if even professional bartenders are fooled by the cues around them, what hope is there for the rest of us? And she said, the government needs to do something about this. Well, I don't know what the government needs to do, but I know what we did in our lab is once we found out that there's a tendency to pour a lot more in short wide glasses than tall skinny glasses, within 4 days, we got rid of all the short wide glasses in our lab. What most of my researchers did within about 2 weeks is they got rid of all the short wide glasses in their home. one guy even got rid of the the red wine glasses and just kept the white wine glasses because, you know, the red wine glasses are more bulbous. Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was taking a little too far, but... Well, so we find that people get tremendously messed up by what's going on. The eating myth, too. So if people serve more from big bowls and wide plates, at least they know when they're full and they can stop before they overeat. Well, we did something a while back where what we ended up doing was we did a study with French people and American people. And we asked them, how do you know when you're through eating dinner? Now, these 150 Parisians would say, I know I'm through eating dinner when I'm no longer hungry or when the food I'm eating no longer tastes good. Now, those are internal cues of satiety. The typical Chicagoan said, I know I'm through eating dinner when, you know, my bowl's empty, when everybody else is through eating, or when the TV show I'm watching is over. So what we did is we developed this endless soup bowl where what happens, that bowl right there is being fed by a big vat of soup that's kind of behind us. She can eat that thing, but unless, if she eats that, the level will go down, it'll slowly come back up. Okay, slowly come back up. To the point that she will never realize it's even happening, but she'll have to eat 6 quarts of soup before she ever sees the bottom. Now, crazily enough, we've done this with 160 people, only 2 people have ever figured anything's going on. One of them because he picked the bowl up. Okay, there we go. And so we end up seeing that they end up eating a lot, but when you get measures of satiety, they go, how can I be any more full? I still have half a bowl of soup left. Now, eating myth number 3, most of the problem is with food eaten away from home. Okay, we've got an article coming out in a couple of months called The Joy of Cooking Too Much. We took The Joy of Cooking's 8 editions out every 10 years, 1937 to 2006. We analyzed the calories and serving sizes for recipes over the years. These are for salads, main dishes, desserts, everything. The result is that all but just one recipe in the entire book increased in calories from 1937. The biggest jumps being right after the war, early 60s, and then in the last edition. And the average calories per serving size increased by 63%. Now, 2/3 of this is due to ingredients, more calorie-dense ingredients, the sauces, you know, nuts, raisins, adding more fat, more sugar, and about 1/3 is due to larger servings. So in review, the stale popcorn study, changing the size of a plate or bowl increases how much we serve and eat. Bottomless bowl study, we don't know when we're full, and the joy of cooking too much, calories of family, recipes have increased. Now, if these cues around our own home can lead us to eat more than we might want, you might say, what hope is there? Okay. What I want to talk about is there's some momentous problems, but I think there's some household solutions. The big problem is that our immediate environment can cause us to overeat. One solution would be, well, change those immediate things that cause us to overeat. Turn them the other way around. If big plates cause us to eat more, use smaller plates. If big bowls cause us to eat more, use smaller bowls. If wide glasses cause us to pour more, use taller glasses. If eye-level foods are more daunting for us, adjust the eye-level foods. Put the healthy ones at eye level. Stockpiling salience mess us up, rearrange the cupboard. And we did an experimental pilot study where we recruited 2,000 volunteers via website www.mindlesseating.org. These are self-selected 41-year-olds, 1.4 years of college, 2.1 kids, 73% Caucasian. And they're randomly assigned to make one change for 3 months. One change every day for 3 months. 20 changes, 100 people per change. The changes were binary. You either did them or you didn't do them. It's not like eat less. You either did it or you didn't do it. It's like you placed wide glasses with thin, you used the half plate rule, you did X, Y, and Z. Now, we tracked the progress for 3 months. What they were asked to do is just put an X on the calendar if they happened to do the change on that particular day. Every week, we had them report their compliance. Every month, we got a progress report. And then we get self-reported measures of weight, well-being, biomarkers, absenteeism, stuff like that. And what we found, I just have the top three tips and the bottom three tips so that the typical person who was instructed to leave food on your plate lost about an average of 2.09 pounds per month. This is self-reported. If they were if they used a salad plate or a 10-inch plate, they lost about 1.97. If they only ate in the kitchen, they lost about 1.5 pounds per month. But if they were told to eat oatmeal as a hot breakfast alternative, they actually gained weight. Okay. If they were told to chew gum when they snacked, they gained weight. If they were told to avoid eating directly out of a package or box, they gained weight. The important thing here is there's a 0.73 correlation between compliance and reported weight loss. Now, the more mindless or convenient the change was to make, the higher the compliance. But the crazy thing was, this monthly weight loss was non-linear over the 3 months, because for many months, losses were 53% higher than in the last month than the first month. So why would people start losing weight at a higher rate? Here's what we started getting an idea about. We followed up another study. Now, these I'll show you a couple pictures here, and these people said I could do this. And it's the ripple effect of a small change. About a year ago, I was giving a talk in Denver, Colorado, and they had a reception afterwards, and this Tom and Cindy came up and said, geez, you know, my husband lost 45 pounds in a year, and I lost 32. And they used this fruit and vegetable rule. The rule was they could never sit down for any lunch or any dinner unless there was a fruit and vegetable on the table. They didn't even have to eat the fruit and vegetable. They just had to be one on the table. Now, is that crazy? Why would you lose 45 pounds in 11 months? Well, I think what happens is there's a ripple effect, and you make that one change, which is reasonably easy to make. It has a ripple effect, and maybe you cook the whole dinner to be a little bit better. And in Tom's case, what he also did was he said, geez, if this is going so well, I'm going to switch from beer to wine. I notice now he has a glass of wine here. And this happened. About a month or so ago, I was giving a bunch of talks in Grand Forks, North Dakota. One of the USDA's has their Human Nutrition Research Center there in Grand Forks. And I'm giving this talk, and this guy comes up to me after the talk, and he's got his coat button like this, and he goes, I've been waiting to show you something all night. I'm saying to myself, oh, Lord, let it be a gun. And he said he lost 34 pounds in 6 or 7 months. The only change he made was he started eating cottage cheese after work. That's crazy talk. How do you lose weight by doing that? What happens, he starts eating cottage cheese. He backs his meal up from 6 o'clock to 7:30. He backs the meal up to 7:30. He's no longer hungry and snacking at 9 o'clock at night. Small ripple effect. Next steps, well, we could conduct a large-scale NIH study to see how small changes work. We could set up a randomized trial to examine long-term differences across different population groups when given a different size dinner plate. But what if we don't want to wait? And what if we wanted to try to make a change today? Well, my group up at Cornell is doing is starting something called the small plate movement. And for families, this means use smaller plates. We've got media partners, the Food Network and the Today Show. We're partnering with a weight loss group you would all know. That's a nonprofit weight loss group. And the small plate challenge is aimed at January 1st. Try it for a month. That's all we're going to ask people to do. For restaurants, look, it's going to save food costs and it saves waste at a buffet. We've got a paper coming out that says that. It increases perceptions of value. And we've got meetings set up with the National Restaurant Association with some large chains. And if you say, well, what's the likelihood of that happening? When we did the research on the tall glasses a while back, I ended up talking to many of the CEOs of the large restaurant chains, the casual dining chains, if you will. And when you tell them you are going to save between 25 and 30% in alcohol costs if you come up with a taller, skinnier glass, you don't even have to do it because you're interested in the consumer drinking less. You can do it just to save money. They responded, not quickly, but they responded within about a year. Final thought, if we want to look at the historical contributors to life expectancy, if we look at what did this in the 1800s, I call it the century of hygiene, because what we learned back then is that maybe physicians should do surgery after washing their hands, and maybe rats aren't really a house pet. Okay. And that contributed a lot to the number of years we had that people lived in. In 1900, what do you guess the average life expectancy was here in the U.S.? Yeah, 46, 47 years. At the end of this last century is 76 to 77. What happened? Well, I call it the century of medicine because we learned about cancer drugs, or penicillin came up, polio vaccines, cool things like that. There's still going to be great things that happen, I think, when it comes to medicine and some of the inventions. But I think this 21st century, if we're going to look at what extends life in a healthy way, it's going to be the century of behavior change. Learning that it's maybe risky to smoke and skydive at the same time. Things like that. Thank you very much.
We have a few minutes for some questions and answers. I'm just going to turn it over. I don't know if this is on.
Yeah, I don't know much about that, but that is probably something I should have put on my list as an economic approach, because my understanding is that we're subsidizing corn enough to drop the price, and that reduces the price of high fructose corn syrup. And if we change that subsidy, that might make a substantial difference. So you're right, I should have put that on there.
So they didn't support either the new missile application or ask you to give me any comments or advice, and then the first question goes on. Eating
is a survival instinct. If we don't eat, we're going to die. So
would you call it a drive?
Absolutely, a drive. As far as making changes, it's going to be slow, and you just have to keep at it and try a number of things. And I think Brian made a lot of good suggestions. Maybe start with small, feasible things and build up, but you have to sort of even have a big picture of where are we heading and what are the kinds of the big things that we need to shoot for in the long run.
California health officers have often talked about sugar tax or dense food tax in order to finance public health programs. Are there jurisdictions that have done that? Every talk all about it, but it's very, the logistics seem very difficult, so I didn't know whether it's ever been done.
I don't know the full answer to your question, but I can say this much, that there are many places where there's a sales tax on junk food, but there isn't a sales tax on other foods. For example, in New York State right now, you have to pay a sales tax on soda, but you don't pay a sales tax on fruits and vegetables or packaged food. Whether the consumer actually sees that, because you pay your sales taxes after you've gone through the register and you just pay your whole total. So whether the consumer actually sees that is another story. As far as an excise tax, where it's levied at the producer or distributor level, I'm not sure if anybody has ever done that, but it certainly seems like a good idea, and I hope somebody tries it soon.
Hi, I wanted to great presentation, really good session. I wanted to get back to the 100-calorie pack issue, because you seem to have some differing conclusions about that, but they were very different studies. And in the first study, you talked about how people that got the 100-calorie pack ate more because people with the bigger ones never opened the bag. And I'm wondering if that has to do with the fact that the situation they were in, maybe they were embarrassed to open the big bag. Whereas I think most of the research does show that smaller packages does lead to smaller consumption. So just wondering if you could speak to that.
I was one of the reviewers on that paper. When we did the original research, we showed that for 70% of the people, this is back in 1995, 70% of the people involved in the basic population, it did help them reduce things. But the other 30%, it either had no effect or they actually did increase. Now, it seems that the differentiating variable is psychological one, and it's whether they're eating restrained or not. Whether they're kind of on the edge so that they blow it, and then go, oh, what the heck? For that segment of people, they don't seem to be quite as uniformly effective. What that study looked at, it measures people based on characteristics, and that's who they use as a sample. So we're just talking about a very kind of isolated part of the population.
Yeah, I was going to say, there are different things going on. I think, when there were many bags of small quantities, it's easier to open when it's just one of many. It's another cue of abundance. So I can just take one because it's a lot less. But if there's only one big bag, you may be less likely to open it. And as far as the plate size, there's actually a study that Barbara Roll published recently where she gave people smaller plates, and in fact, it didn't work.
Where they actually reduced the smaller. Yeah, I think what was going on in that study was those were all done in sort of the eating cubicles. It wasn't really a social environment, it wasn't sort of a social environment, the same as the stacking environment that most of us are supposed to be in.
Hi, Pete, that was a great session. There's probably a connection somewhere between sleeping and obesity. Some of it is that obesity makes it hard to sleep, but it's probably some the other way around, right? At least I've been led to believe that that's true. There's a Freakonomics-like argument that says light bulbs are the cause of obesity because we're just awake longer, and we can have 24-hour schedules that we could never have before. I just wondered if you had any comments about that.
I just have some speculation. I think a lot of our ability to make good decisions have to do with how well our brain is functioning. Glucose in the brain, but probably rest and so on. I think when we're tired, we make worse decisions. We resort to the heuristics, to the impulsive decision making, and I think that helps me contribute. We're just more fatigued, and then we do
points of procedural kind of plan that might someday fight champions, it might be accurate, it might not go anywhere. We're fortunate to have our audience, the Surgeon General, who's here, and he had a tremendous idea of going to all the different communities and having BC travel with BC initiatives. We're going to be related to productivity, the food, and saying, what's being done right now? Because once you click all that data in the bottom, we can start synthesizing some great ideas. We don't have to start at the top, we can start at the bottom and do something we need to start now.
Hi, that was a fabulous presentation. I had a question for Mr. Farley on policy. Michael Pollan, who's a really popular author and really interested in food and agricultural interests in this country, recently wrote an open letter to the presidential candidates. And one of the things he suggested that the federal government should do to address this issue is to define food as, you know, that not everything that's edible is necessarily food, that food has a certain minimal standard in terms of macronutrients and micronutrients, and things that are absent of those qualities we don't call food. And of course, this would have huge implications for the food stamp program and for the institution of food that we purchase. And it would also send a message to the general public about, you know, that there's food that you eat to nourish your body, and then there's non-food edible items that you eat for enjoyment. And I was just wondering what you thought of that, if that made things more feasible or less feasible in terms of policy.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that letter, but having been involved in some policy discussions where we were trying to keep unhealthy foods out of certain environments, we quickly ran into the issue of, you know, what's good and what's bad. And we had certain things that everybody agreed was bad and other things everyone agreed was good, and then there were things in the middle, and it was tough. I do think that if we could come up with a definition of whether you want to call it food and non-food or good foods and bad foods, that would take us a whole lot further as far as instituting any kind of policy, whether it's local, state, or federal level. So I love the idea.
Say hi.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
Good.
Good.
Thanks very much for coming. I appreciate you coming. Hey, Mel, how's it going?
Good. I gave him your book.
Oh, you did.
And I read it.
Did you? Great. Yeah, great. Well, I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Hello.
Hi,
how are you?
Barbara
Steve Goldson.
Nice to meet you. And thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Barbara. Yeah, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Hi there. How are you? So, are you going to write all this down in a paper that can go into one of the transition teams?
I did this just because Deborah twisted my arm.
Yeah,
I,
yeah.
You know, during the last minute,
I mean, seriously, I don't know if you mind sharing your story, but I'm going to be in HHS during the transition. I don't know what it is. And I'm looking for ideas and things to present to the incoming teams. You don't worry about things.
No, not really. You want me to email them?
Yeah, that would be great.
Any way you want to do it.
Well,
I mean, recognizing all
both.
The uncertainties
I mean,
are in this.
I'd love to have your slides, but then if, you know, depending on what happens, it would be great to have you come down. We get a sympathetic ear.
Great. Let me just card in case you want to reach me.
I mean, I think we have, no matter who wins the election, we have a really good opportunity. And I really want to take advantage of it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, whoever comes in, it's going to be covered from the change.
Right.
So we can say, this is one thing
yes. And this is, how can you be opposed to this? I think there's an incredible opportunity right now. They're going to be looking for exciting policy initiatives, no matter who comes in, things they can do. So.
And I mean, I think some of these are best done locally.
Yeah,
some are best
exactly.
State, but
yeah,
there's
yeah,
some federal.
Some federal, yeah.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Farley, I'm Molly.
Hi, how are you?
I work with Deborah.
Oh, yes. Oh,
I should probably, like, come over and meet you, because I've, like, heard your voice, but I don't know how to
talk. I'm going to try to stop it, yeah. I'm probably toward the beginning. Yeah,
I'll look for you.
Okay, great. Yeah, we're doing good stuff. Rolling with some of the data.
Even though I'm getting policies, I'm kind of...
Aaron with me.